Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Beat. We're a week late in starting our season, so we can only apologise that we were at Thorpe Park winning teddy bears for our girls while Art and Kaya got lost in a maze. To really improve the standard of our pod this year, I've been to Poundland to purchase a whiteboard and some light bulbs. While it seems such a promising start to the season is not down to some astute signings, but rather Mikel Arteta playing episodes of the Arsenal Beat over the loudspeakers during training sessions. I'm joined today by Sam Dean of The Telegraph, and fresh from being snubbed by Jay Ling's Simon Collins of the Evening Standard. Guys, I was unfortunately not there on Saturday due to family commitments, enjoying the sunshine with a beer, but Sam, the football was almost just as jolly, wasn't it, for Arsenal fans?
Liquid football, Mark. Liquid. It was very good, actually. I thought 4-2 was a flattering scoreline for Leicester. I think Arsenal could easily have scored 5 or 6, and Leicester were probably quite fortunate to score 2, which I think also was quite encouraging for Arsenal, because it felt to me, watching it, like the attack clicked into gear far more effectively than it had done against Crystal Palace on the opening day. Obviously, Arsenal were quite good against Palace, but they weren't great, whereas this was a different level, really, I think, of attacking performance. Martinelli was excellent. And obviously, I'm sure we'll come on to him a bit in more depth, but Gabriel Jesus, I think that was, you know, I mean, it's probably, he probably announced himself to a degree during pre-season when he was just fantastic. But for a first competitive couple of goals and a first competitive home game, he was genuinely superb and just offered so much that Arsenal had been missing in their attack for many years now. So plenty of reasons to feel optimistic. And yeah, the mood feels pretty good. The atmosphere was great. I'm sure Simon will agree. And there are moments in there too with the support for Saliba after the own goal. And Arteta referenced this post-match as well. But that was genuinely quite a powerful and profound moment. And it feels like things are happening, which I know we keep saying. And with Arsenal, could always age badly. But that's the truth of it right now, and that's how I feel.
Simon, I wanted to ask you, we'll come on to talk about people like Jesus and Zinchenko and things like that. I wanted to ask you about Granit Xhaka, someone that all the fans are aware of. Most of them have had, you know, a checkered history with him, as he has with the club, of course. But how impressed with him have you been? Not only on Saturday, but, you know, we spoke to him recently as well, and he played well at Palace. Is he starting to now prove what all these managers have apparently seen in him since he joined Arsenal?
Yeah. I think he's been brilliant, and ended up doing a piece on him today, just about his sort of form and rebirth. And the conclusion I'd sort of come to is that he's just playing with freedom and living with freedom, you know, both on and off the pitch. He spoke on Saturday after the game and explained he'd actually spoken with Mikel, who said to him, look, you've got more license this season, the way we're going to play, you know, to get forward. And we've seen that in basically, I mean, Arsenal are almost playing like a 2-3-5 when they're in possession, and basically Zinchenko and White are sort of joining party in the midfield. And Jack is pushing right high up that pitch. And I know Sam highlighted it in his piece for The Telegraph as well, but his touches inside the box, his shots are way up from what he normally is. And he just looks liberated. And it ties in with what I felt off the pitch, whereby, you know, us three will know, we've spoken to him numerous times, spoke to him at the start of this season, but him opening up on the social media abuse he suffered, I think just kind of feels like it's been a weight off his shoulders. He's become a bit of a role model, I think, for people suffering with sort of that level of abuse. He's become a real standard bearer, I think, for players in the whole game. And yeah, just seeing him speak so openly, I kind of feel like he's changed people's perceptions of him. And I think fans who abused him before would think twice about doing that now. And yeah, it's just great to see. And I think if you'd gone and said this, you know, 2 years ago when Arteta came in and that Palace fallout was fresh in the minds, that we'd be talking about him like this. I think Xhaka himself said he wouldn't believe it. And it's a remarkable comeback, really, and something that's been nice to see.
On the sort of tactical rebirth and reinvention of Xhaka, which I don't think many of us saw coming, I don't think anyone saw coming at all. So he got, he took 4 touches in the Leicester box this weekend, which is the most he's ever taken in a Premier League game. He's done four on three other occasions, so it's his joint most. And those occasions were all since February this year. So we saw it a bit last season post the Dubai trip, where Xhaka was sort of playing a bit higher up as that left-sided eight. And I think Zinchenko's signing has accelerated that. And we saw that the way that Zinchenko comes into holding midfield, which is basically where Xhaka has played in that left-sided holding midfield position for years. And if he's there, then Xhaka can go further forward. And I think Xhaka looks, as you said, Simon, happy, liberated, and in many ways, a totally different player.
I mentioned it in that before asking Simon the question there about how all the managers have clearly respected his abilities since he joined the club. But just to your point, I think it proves now that Arteta seems to know how to use him. Like he joined the club and everyone thought he was this defensive midfielder. Then I remember doing a press conference with Arsene Wenger where Wenger said he doesn't know how to tackle and he's too old now to be taught how to tackle. And everyone thought, hold on, is this hard defensive midfielder that can't tackle? But that's clearly not his game. We've seen the best of him now. And like you say, he's popping up in those positions now that you would never dream of seeing him in the past. You know, I associate him really with, you know, those long range strikes that he almost always scores against Manchester United, things like that. But he could well get 6, 7, 8 goals this season if he keeps playing like that, couldn't he, Simon?
Definitely. And I think what we've seen from managers, they've always liked his character and his personality. And I think he probably really hasn't had at Arsenal a system like he's got now where he truly fits it. And I certainly think in that Wenger time, remember watching him play and in that position where he was not quite playing where Partey was, but in front of the defence, he just wasn't mobile enough or good enough in the tackle to play that role. You know, he was giving away sort of clumsy fouls, yellow cards, but being, you know, this position where he's further forward looks completely different. And one of my friends who's, you know, a big Bundesliga fan and watches a lot of Bundesliga football, he was saying this is similar to what he had at Gladbach when he was playing with Kramer, who would sit and be more rigid and give Xhaka that license to roam and get forward. And yeah, I mean, it'd be huge for Arsenal if he does get a lot more goals, because that has been the thing all last season. There wasn't enough goals. And if he can chip in with 6, 7 goals, I mean, that would be a massive boost.
On your point about long-range goals, Mark. So this was his 15th goal for Arsenal and only his 5th inside the box. So he's obviously scored the majority of his goals from range. And with all due respect to Wenger, the great man, I don't think Mikel Arteta would subscribe to the view that any player is too old to learn anything. I think it's interesting that Wenger would say, you know, too old to learn now, whereas Arteta's taken Xhaka 4 or 5 years down the line and said, you're not too old to learn how to play a new role. And that is the difference in coaching.
It's also mad that, you take it at face value and Xhaka says, you know, I had my suitcase packed and I was ready to go. That shows that Arteta's clearly a great man manager as well as he is a tactician. Well, it remains to be seen how great he is, but he's certainly doing well this season. I think that comes across in the documentary, which I know we're going to talk about later. Just sticking with what we saw on Saturday, Simon, are there any concerns at all over the defence? That's, you know, conceding 2 goals. I think Ramsdale arguably should have done better with the second one, shouldn't he?
Yeah, that for me was the only real concern with it, because both the goals sort of came out of nothing, really. I mean, that the first goal is just a long ball pumped forward, flick-ons one, to mix up between Saliba and Ramsdale, and it goes in. And the second one, you know, Madison, he's quite a narrow angle there. Shot's not blocked. Then it goes through Ramsdale's leg at a tight angle. So both those goals were quite sort of goals that in the past we've been used to seeing Arsenal concede, where they concede out of nothing and you think, that's too easy for the opposition to score. They haven't really worked for that goal. And they had eradicated that, certainly the large parts of the first half of last season. Towards the end of last season, I think it had snuck back in. And I think it was Albinio today, obviously, the Opta stat man, who said they've only kept 1 clean sheet in their last 9 games, stretching back towards last season, Arsenal. So I think the defence is something that needs to tighten up a bit. I just think that has always been the fear whenever Arteta, the whole of Arteta's reign, particularly the start, was that Arsenal would do something that would get the opposition back into the game too easily. I think now they've got a bit more firepower where we can see, sort of the weekend, you know, they concede and then they just go and score another goal. which might change that. But, you know, we spoke to Zinchenko in the mix and afterwards, and he made the point, you know, he's obviously played at Man City, but he was like, conceding two goals of back line is far too many. Like, we can't be doing that. So that, I think, will be something that Arteta will look to address. But it's a new back line, isn't it? New personnel, and probably still maybe working themselves out a little bit.
Sam, on that new defensive back line, with a player like Zinchenko, we don't know his long-term position. At the moment, he's first-choice left-back. Do you kind of have to take that he's not going to be as good defensively to then have the payoff of that, those numbers he'll give you at the other end of the pitch?
Yeah, I think so. I think the argument will be he will help Arsenal to control the game better and therefore will have to defend less as a team. That makes sense. I do think there will be occasions when Tierney is chosen ahead of him. I think the fact that Zinchenko got pulled out of the game against Palace after Jordan Ayew had gone past him a few times and Zinchenko got replaced by Tierney again in the last 15 minutes on Saturday, I think, you know, and Arsenal trying to solidify and set up shop a bit. I think Tierney is the better defender and will be more suitable against certain opponents, but certainly there's no denying that Zinchenko adds something else to that midfield. And also, something that really struck me at the weekend was he just kind of, like, he reeks of competitiveness, if that makes sense. Like, his absolute, like, the ferocity of his celebrations when the penalty got overturned before half-time. He was, like, properly, like, screaming in the referee's face and, like, fist-pumping. And then when the second goal went in, the Maddison goal, he was absolutely furious. And he was sort of the one, like, he looked like he got, was about to sort of jump off the top of the stadium. He was so angry about the whole thing. And he, you could see how much it mattered to him to concede one goal. Whereas, you know, historically, Arsenal players haven't always visibly cared about that. They go, oh, you know, we'll try and play and try and score another one at the other end. But it was like a personal affront to him that a goal had gone in, even though Arsenal were doing quite well. And I think that kind of attitude and mentality is obviously what you'd expect at Man City. And I imagine that Jesus is very much the same. And I think that's a key thing they've brought to the squad.
You could go into marketing there, I think, right? Reeks of competitiveness sounds like an eau de toilette where we could get, you know, Zinchenko on the advert, smouldering on the back of a horse or something. But just on that one, and I've just Googled it because I do remember it at the time, but Newcastle United, when Rafa Benitez was there, he used an analogy called the short blanket. Now, I don't know if you two are aware of this, so I've got the quote here.
And it's great.
And it was basically, if you cover your head, you have cold feet, but if you cover your feet, you have your head cold. And the idea being, can you defend really well and attack really well? And only the teams that can do that are going to challenge at the top end of the league. Do you think that's something that Mikel probably, one of the only things really he's got left to sort is just making sure that they can keep tight? That should have been 4-0, for example, on Saturday, shouldn't it?
I think Mikel would say, if you attack really well, defending is easier. And that's something that Pep Guardiola's always said, you know, the fundamental premise of they can't score if we have the ball. I think Arteta wouldn't divide it so much between defence and attack. I think he would see them as basically intrinsically linked. But yeah, I mean, for me, the one concern so far, or the biggest concern so far, has been the slightly unexpected wobbliness of Ramsdale. I think I'm not convinced that he was at fault at all for the Saliba own goal, but I think he might have been. I think he was sort of charging out and he timed his forward movement in such a way that when the ball was past him, he couldn't really react, if that makes sense. Like, he was sort of caught off balance by it. Maybe that's really too critical of Ramsdale. And also, I'm not a goalkeeper specialist, so I can't tell you whether Maddison's shot going through his legs is bad or not, but it didn't look great from where we were. Especially because didn't Ramsdale tweet during the Euros, the women's Euros, about staying clever and keeping them together? So that didn't take particularly long to come back and bite him. So that'll be my main concern defensively at the moment. But that might just be personal confidence and personal form. So I don't know if it's a structural thing.
I do wonder as well, we're going to go into transfers now, but like Leno's gone. And I know not everyone rated Leno, but you felt he was a genuine number two who, you know, and I'm not saying this would happen now, but if you just fancy getting Ramsdale out of the limelight, you know, if he dropped a clanger at Bournemouth next week and you thought, let's just get him out of that team for a week or so, Leno would easily come in, as he did at Villa last year. But, you know, Turner's a new goalkeeper to the league, isn't he? So that would be a strange situation if they were to lose Ramsdale or decide that they wanted to give him that break. They do seem weaker in that position than they were last year. But arguably, that's the only position on that pitch where they seem weaker. Simon, you've got to look at Gabriel Jesus here as surely one of the signings of the summer in the Premier League. I mean, for me, I think Darwin Nunez will be great. I think Haaland's a great signing for City. But in terms of completely changing an attack, I don't think they'll have the impact of a Jesus, will they?
Yeah, I think in my pre-season predictions for the paper, I gave Jesus as signing of the season just because, I mean, Haaland's probably on a par in terms of a team desperately needing that sort of striker, but I think City did okay without one. But it was so obvious what Arsenal needed. You know, that number nine was an absolute critical signing, and it's no surprise they got it done before pre-season started and they got the player they wanted. But yeah, you saw at the weekend the way it just transformed the whole attack. And I think as much as it's transformed them going, you know, with the ball in possession, I think out of possession, you got a sense as well at how different it was. I think that press last season, it worked at times. I think it actually worked better when Nketiah was in the team. But with Jesus leading that press, Saka and Martinelli, you know, they were absolutely on that Leicester defence, really didn't give him any opportunity. And that, I think, is going to be as big a weapon as he is going to be in possession. I think the way that they're going to be able to defend from the front will make a huge difference. And, you know, Sam sort of touched it there, but, you know, attacking is the best way of defending. And I think if they can defend from the front, any sort of concerns there might be lingering about some defensive rigidity will evaporate, I think. And yeah, it's just, it's night and day seeing the way Arsenal attack compared to last season. And I think Jesus has just brought out the best in Martinelli. There's not so much reliance on Saka. So, I mean, it's all so positive right now. And the test will be, can he keep this going for 38 games? Because we don't really know with Jesus what he's like over a 30-game season. And Arteta, I think he touched on it briefly. I can't remember if it was post-match or pre-match, but about how, you know, they need to sort of manage his minutes a bit because he hasn't really been the main man. You know, he hasn't been asked to play 40 matches. And now we're going to see what he's like, and the early signs suggest he's going to revel in it.
Does it? The status thing is important and relevant with Jesus, because obviously when he went to City, he signed as a teenager and he was always sort of the young understudy. And then I think when you, maybe in any industry or any world, but when you join a company or a club at that point, it's probably quite hard to shake that feeling that you are the sort of more junior kind of guy or the young guy that everyone looks at as a sort of a nice lad, good potential and everything. But moving to Arsenal and being told straight away, you are the number nine, you are the main man, you are part of the leadership group, you are seen as the guy to teach Saka and Martinelli and Smith Rowe. I think he seems to have, from what we've seen early doors anyway, absolutely embraced that responsibility and that kind of authority that comes with his position. And I think people this season will say, well, why didn't he do this at Man City? Or why didn't City see this sign of Jesus and keep it? And I think maybe that's part of it, that the way he feels and the onus that is on him, I think, as far as we've seen after two games at least, is bringing out a different and better side to him.
I think the only other question mark I'd have over him, I also think that first goal on Saturday, really underrated, that would be up for goal of the month, I think. But is...
Action.
If they go 2-3-4 games without a win, 2-3-4 games losing on the bounce, which they did last season. We know, and I know it's one of those old fables, it's easy to do in this league. He's not used to that either, is he? He's not used to being in a team that might have their back to the wall or anything like that. So everything's, you know, sunny and rosy for him at the moment, as it is for Arsenal. But you do wonder if they get to a point where they're desperate for wins and desperate to nick a point here and there. Is he going to be okay? Is he going to keep his head up and, you know, burden that responsibility of getting goals? And it's something that he hasn't had to do yet. So it will be interesting to see. Sam, Jesus aside, I suppose Zinchenko, you focused on recently as well. How good has he been so far? Are there more question marks there in a similar vein, do you think?
Well, I think as discussed, he's clearly changing the shape of the team and bringing out more from Xhaka. I think the questions, as I mentioned before with the Tierney point, I think the questions are probably over his sort of one versus one defensive capabilities. And I'm looking forward to, at one point, I think maybe in the Europa League, seeing Zinchenko and Vieira in the same team. Arteta mentioned that Vieira would probably compete with Xhaka for that more advanced left-sided position. And obviously, from what we know of Vieira, none of us have actually seen him play yet, but from what we know of him, he would treat that role very differently to how Xhaka does. And looking at some of the combinations between Xhaka and Zinchenko, I think that was actually Arsenal's most frequent pass combination on Saturday. You know, throw in a kind of more creative Odegaard-style player in that, and that might bring out a different, more creative style to Zinchenko too, for example. So that will be interesting to see that relationship and that balance too. But yeah, no, I mean, clearly Jesus and Zinchenko have already made a big impact.
Simon, difficult one for you here. Do they still need to add more? I know they would like to. Every club would want to. Do you think they need to?
Yeah, I mean, I debated this last week in a piece, and in the end, the sort of conclusion I came to was, I think if you can do a deal for Tielemans for 25 million, irrespective of whether you massively need him right now, I think the finances involved in that for me are too good a deal to walk away from. And I would go and get it done. I think the squad actually looks fairly sort of set up for the season, particularly with the Europa League. I think, you know, when it's Europa League, the sort of players that you're rotating in for that, as opposed to Champions League, don't have to be as, you know, as high level. You know, the winger, I think they definitely need someone long term to provide competition and to take some of the heat off Saka. But I think in the Europa League, you could probably get away with, I know he's out injured now, but Reece Nelson could probably, certainly during the group stages, could do a job there. You know, you could probably move sort of Fabio Vieira out onto the right wing.
You could play your record signing on the right wing in the Europa
You could
League,
also play your record signing, who I'd immediately forgotten of, which says quite a lot. So
this
I think...
This year.
I think, yeah, I reckon we can get one more Pepe false dawn story out of us. but yeah, so I kind of feel the squad's quite set up, but I just, for me, I mean, I know he had a bad game at the weekend, Tielemans, and he looked like he wanted to be anywhere else other than that pitch, apart from when he got a standing ovation from the Arsenal fans. I do think if there's a deal like that to be done at that fee, I kind of feel like it's too good to walk away from, because I think Sam and I chatted about it off the pod, where we had said, you know, in a year's time, Xhaka's going to be 30 with a year on his deal. And then, sorry to say this, Mark could leave because his contract might expire and they might not take up the option. Suddenly, you know, Tielemans becomes a player you want to have in that team. So it's a difficult one, but I think it's a rarity as us as well for to be, what are we, 15, 16 days from the end of the window, and say, if Arsenal didn't do anything, it wouldn't be a crisis. Whereas quite often it's like they need to get 2-3 more players in here. Otherwise, the squad's not ready for the season.
Sam, looking back at last summer quickly, and I know the answer to this because you and I spoke about it at Brighton last week, but the pod will be delighted to hear your opinion on this. They signed Tomiyasu, they signed Ben White. This summer they've got Saliba back. What's that back four look like when Arteta's got a full strength squad? So essentially, what will that back four look like, for example, at Bournemouth on Saturday?
I think it will look the same as it is now. I think Ben White brings more to the right back position, certainly with the ball, than Tomiyasu does. And I've liked the look of White at right back. I think he's technically a better passer. And I know he gave the ball away a few times against Palace and he got criticised for that, but, you know, it happens. I like the look of him. And I think he's obviously, defensive instincts are good as a centre-back primarily. So I quite like that balance right now. I think Saliba obviously is being excellent and deserves to keep his place. And we know how much having a left-footed centre-back matters to Arteta in terms of that balance of distribution. So for me, I think White is now ahead of Tomiyasu. And also with Tomiyasu, while he was very good in the first half of last season, there were still games in that run and towards the end of the season when he came back, admittedly not particularly in good shape, where I think 1v1, he struggled quite a few times. And there were moments when defensively he looked a little bit unsure of himself. Whereas White, I think, is a bit more reliable when it comes to that kind of thing, despite having his own issues in some games last season too. He's by no means the finished article either. But yeah, I think maybe if you're going to play the way they are now, which is with White sort of tucking in and Zinchenko tucking in too, then White suits that better than Tomiyasu and certainly better than Cedric, who's obviously more of an overlapping wide right back.
Do we think it's a case of quite... you know, horses for courses in terms of who he picks. I think last season a bit of an issue was that basically you had your first choice back four and just played that in every single game where you could. But I think now there's an argument for certain games. You sort of touched earlier, Sam, but I think if you were playing, obviously he's no longer in the Premier League, but against someone like a sort of Rafinha type, you know, really attacking winger, I'd probably prefer to play Tierney over Zinchenko. Tomiyasu, I think there's an argument against someone like Bournemouth who've got Kiefer Moore and, you know, pretty good from set pieces, big tall side. Do you maybe play Tomiyasu over Ben White? So I think now there is a legitimate decisions for Arteta to make in defence whereby he goes, actually, no, this is a game that suits Tierney. This is a game that suits Tomiyasu. Whereas last season, it was like, right, we need to get this four out. And in case of emergency, we'll break the glass and play Rob Holding for 15 minutes.
That still exists. That does still exist.
Yeah, that still exists. So I think that might actually be a thing now where the team sort of shifts depending on who the opposition is.
That's true. Also, further up the pitch, I suppose, just coming back to Sam's point, with once Vieira's up and running, him and Xhaka do such a different role in that same position. You imagine he can pick depending on if he thinks he needs more physicality. We know Vieira, for example, is quite slight. We spoke to Edu in the mix zone a few weeks ago, and he was saying they don't want him to get any bigger at the moment. They like the idea of having this tricky little player. They don't want him to bulk up at the moment, which is quite interesting. But maybe that is because he is a complete opposite option in that position to Granit Xhaka. We're running out of time, boys, but I did want to touch on the All or Nothing documentary. I think we all pop up in it, faces and questions and that throughout. There have been plenty of reviews of it, but Sam, I'll come to you first on this one. What, as a journalist, as someone who covers Arsenal, how do you think the Arsenal journalists came across Mark Owen in particular, obviously getting a mention from Mikel?
That was a funny moment when, so Mikel effectively says, post-press conference, that was a very fair and good question by Mark Owen. but the answer to the question itself at the time was almost like, how dare you ask me that question? That's a terrible question. The press conferences sometimes, they're always authentic. Obviously, I'm not trying to question authenticity, but it sometimes was a bit like a game in a way that the way a question is asked and, you know, I think Mikel sometimes knows what we're trying to get at, but doesn't want to go there or vice versa. And, you know, that was a good example of how Arteta has a face on in a press conference and says what he needs to say or feels like he should say. And then afterwards we'll go privately. Yeah, fair question. Or in, you know, I'm sure in other cases it was not a fair question. And that's fine too. There's not much sort of insight in the documentary about how the press conferences really function, but I wouldn't expect that because I don't think fans care massively beyond the really, really sort of intense ones. We don't see a huge amount of game-changing insider analysis, given that there were cameras at every single press conference. The amount of hours of footage they've got of us asking middling questions for months on end, they've not used a huge amount of it. But I've not seen the final two episodes, so maybe you know more than me.
No, all I know is I asked a question in the next one, which is a glorious. Obviously, it's top draw question that he didn't answer. much like when I tried to have a little joke with him the other day about his son being a good goalkeeper, and as you pointed out, Sam, he clearly hadn't seen that episode yet, so that was quite insane.
Simon, what was his response to that?
He just went, "Ah." Cheers. Simon, there was an interesting bit for me in that same scenario where he spoke about Mark Owen's question, where he said, "We didn't give them any highlights." And I think that kind of sums up, not just Mikel, but that sums up when a manager goes into a press conference these days, he's not walking in there to suddenly fill the back pages, is he?
No, and you get different managers in press conferences, and certain ones, you know, particularly Mourinho, would come in there with the sort of narrative that they wanted to get across. And this was the point that they wanted to stress. And it, you would, whatever you asked, that's what you were going to come out writing about. And I think Mourinho was the best at that. Arteta isn't really like that. He's normally pretty straight. And we were sort of saying the other day, Sam and I, he's actually at his best when he sort of backs against the wall and he has to come out fighting a bit, particularly when he's defending his players. And, you know, I always remember the sort of last season when he was saying, you know, fire the bullets at me, my chest is here. that's when he's at his best. When things are actually going fine, he's normally pretty chilled and mellow. And you can't really, I mean, there have been times that we've been at press conferences, haven't they, where journalists have tried to go at him and antagonize him, and he just sort of shuts it down and just won't really go there.
It's a bad approach. That doesn't work with him.
It's a bad approach. But he will open up at certain points. And I think you sort of get it a bit towards the end of the documentary, which obviously starts in the Zoom era and finishes with us being there. There's a small bit where you sort of joke with him, Mark, that you know he's one manager of the month, and there's now a curse of it, which means you lose your next game. And there's a bit of a laugh and a joke about it. And those things really don't happen on Zoom. You just don't have the same atmosphere. And I think we've seen it a bit more ever since journalists have come back face to face with Mikel. There is a slightly better relationship with those of us who go regularly. He is opening up a bit more. And yeah, I just feel like that era when he was really struggling and the team was struggling, taking place over Zoom, did not help his cause at all, really.
Just, this is a very general point, and maybe you guys wouldn't agree, and maybe he wouldn't agree, but I think most managers, and Arteta is definitely among them, would happily never do a pre-match press conference ever again. I think some of them quite like it or see value in it. Mourinho is certainly one of them. And I think Conte very much knows how to play a press conference too. But I think Arteta would happily just never do one ever again. I think post-match, he doesn't mind it as much because he knows it's a good chance to sort of maybe sort of spread a certain message. But generally speaking, I don't think he really wants to be there. And that is fine. That doesn't bother us at all. We know we know what our job is. He knows what his job is. And it's our job. I'm going a bit of a tangent here, but people think sometimes that journalists are there trying to catch managers out. We're not. We're really not. We want them to be interesting. That's what we want. We want them to be interesting because we want our stuff to be interesting to fans and to readers because that's what our job is. So we're not trying to annoy him or antagonise him or say something to rile him up. We want him to be interesting and open. And there are different ways of doing it with different managers. And I think he is someone who sort of knows the game a bit now. And we've been dealing with him for 2 years, 2.5 years. So we kind of know what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I agree with what Simon was saying as well about if they're doing well, he seems a bit more vanilla, if you like. But I also think that comes across with his team talks in that documentary. He seems much better when the team are losing or whatever. He seems to really get the passion going and get drumming into his players. Whereas, obviously, when they're winning, you're just kind of trotting along nicely. But that does kind of mirror it, I think, with his press conferences. We've spoken to him a few times, and I remember they lost those three games, didn't they? And then he said he was offered his new contract after those three games. And it was a bit like, you know, that's quite an interesting thing. I remember, didn't he also say, it's in the documentary, he says, I've had the best week. This has been the best week of my career because of how the players reacted to that. And that's something he'd said to us in a press conference. Mm. So you do get the impression that he does tell the truth. I don't think he just comes in and thinks, you know, I'm just going to fob these guys off. But at the same time, we have been at arm's length. But again, that might be because for the majority of the time he's been in charge, we've been on faces on the computer screen, haven't we? Which is, you know, that's not ideal for anybody. And certainly, I don't even think managers would have preferred that. That must have been a weird thing. I'd like to ask a manager about that. Like, yes, they don't want us in the room. They don't want us prying with questions. But surely that's better than, like I say, just switching between a screen where people are still forgetting to unmute themselves and, you know, dogs are barking in the background and stuff. But it's an interesting documentary, that one. I think it's definitely got better as the episodes have progressed. I think the access must have got better when that relationship between the cameras and the club have improved. But I'm going to put you both on the spot a bit here. And we're only talking, obviously, we're not talking about the last two, which haven't dropped on Amazon yet. But what was the bit of the documentary you saw that surprised you the most? I'll come to Sam first.
Having known the sort of involvement that Arsenal had with the editing of the footage, I didn't expect to see as much of the Aubameyang situation as I did. I thought, for example, the conversations between Edu, Vinay Gateshwar and Richard Garlick were very interesting, not least because they were clearly ignored by Arteta when they said we should put Oba back in the team. Clearly, no, said Arteta. And the, you know, the chat with one of Oba's agents and Edu on the phone, I think that was...
Going to Disneyland.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a little bit of insight and sort of behind the scenes access that we knew they would have had it on camera, but we didn't know how much of it would make it to the final cut. So I was pleased to see that, and that was for me the most sort of surprising and interesting bit so far.
Simon,
for me, the stuff with the speakers before the Liverpool game, just because I've never seen that, and also I was amazed that that had happened. They had lost, and that hadn't come out. You know, Arsenal a few years ago was a very leaky club, but for that to not come out until the documentary, I think is a sign of how Arteta is keeping things under wraps a lot more than used to be the case at London Colney.
Shit journalists.
Yeah,
could also be that.
Yeah, definitely that. That's a perfect place to end. Three more shit journalists will join you later in the week to preview the trip to Bournemouth. Thanks to Sam and Simon. Have a good week, everyone.